Arts Connection, the intersection of faith and the arts in Canadian culture. With your host, Robert White. Now, here's Robert.
Welcome to Arts Connection. Tonight's guest has combined her interest in music and destigmatizing mental health issues to create the award-winning novel, A Secret Music. The book, Susan Doherty's first novel, which was set in Montreal during the 1930s, follows the story of a 15-year-old piano prodigy who grew up in the shadow of his mother's mental illness. Susan is on the phone with us tonight from her home in Montreal to talk about A Secret Music. But before we get to the interview, let's listen to Matin from the Mike Janssen's Nudging Forever CD. Now to our conversation with Susan Doherty. Good evening, Susan.
Hi, Robert. Nice to be here.
Yeah. Well, let's give our listeners a bit of a chance to get to know who you are and a little bit about you. When did you first start writing?
My first degree, college degree, was in human biology. And then I realized that wasn't really where I wanted to spend most of my life. And then I took magazine journalism at Ryerson and then ended up working at Maclean's magazine. And then, do you know how fate intervenes? And at the time when I was working at Maclean's, they had a pagination that was all done cut and paste. And
Maclean's
had a job for someone to do the computer pagination for Maclean Hunter, starting with Maclean's magazine. But the person needed to have a science background and a journalism background, and the only person in the entire Maclean Hunter world was me. So I ended up getting the job, and it took me kind of down a different path. I mean, Time magazine had used this computer pagination, Maclean's, and then the International Herald Tribune bought the same system, and they were looking for a bilingual person who could introduce the system to their employers. So I ended up moving to Paris, which was incredible, and then the Independent in London, England, used the same system. So I really felt like I was just living under a lucky star. It was so incredible to get to live and work in all these different cities. And then when I came back to Canada, I didn't want to work at McLean's anymore. If there's any kind of catastrophe on a Thursday or a Friday, you work all day Saturday and all day Sunday because, of course, the magazine comes out on Monday.
Right.
So anyway, that's a long way to say that I left journalism and did something else for 18 years. And then in 2004, I began to take creative writing courses at U of T. And one of the professors read a little scene, and she said, "Susan, I really think this is a novel."
Well, one of the things you did is you did a commemorative study. Your first book was actually a commemorative history book, which I'm assuming, you know, kind of went back on your journalism background. But sort of what took you down the path to novel writing? Because you've got a Secret Music, and I know in our conversations we've had earlier, you're also looking at working on another novel. So sort of what led you down that path toward novel writing?
Well, I mean, I guess it was just these creative writing courses that I took at U of T, and Kelly Deese was one of the instructors, one of the professors there, and she read one of my pieces of work, and she said, "I really think that this has a novel potential," and she was absolutely right. It became a really important scene in A Secret Music, and from Kelly, I ended up taking the mentorship program at the Humber School for Writers and working with Sandra Birdsall. And it was an incredible partnership. I mean, I worked with her for 7 months and had a first draft at the end of the mentorship program. And, you know, she said to me, "Don't rush. This is a really dirty, ugly first draft. Don't rush it out to publishers yet. Do another draft, edit, look at the characters that need to be dropped, look at the scenes that need to be further fleshed out." But she was so inspiring to me that I just couldn't wait to get editing and doing more on the book. And then Kevin Doyle, who had been the editor of McLean's when I was there, he was a very shy, reserved man. He came in on the heels of Peter Newman, who was also a shy, reserved person. But Kevin was such a support to me. He read one of my early drafts and just said, "This is going to be fantastic." And so, you know, I've had several people who've been, you know, pushing me forward and inspiring me and keeping me going.
Well, you've mentioned a couple of these people. In terms of influences in that, as you've been writing, were there any writers that sort of seemed to be people that you look to as influences, either people you've met or people that you've just read?
I guess my favorite author is Flannery O'Connor, and part of the reason I love her so much is her books are all character-driven, and, you know, she died young. She died at 39 years of age of lupus, so, I mean, her talent at such a young age was really something very, very special, and I think what I like about Flannery's work is that she doesn't resolve anything, and it's actually one of the criticisms of her work is that there isn't this powerful redemptive ending in a lot of her short stories. She was really known for her short stories, but she always opens the door, and the reader knows that the character has a choice to go through the door or to make things better, but Flannery doesn't solve it for the reader. She doesn't solve it for the character, and that's one of the powerful aspects of her writing that I absolutely love. And then as for Canadian writers, I mean, Anne-Marie MacDonald and Roe Hinton Mystery really paved the way for me. I mean, character-driven books, Fall on Your Knees and, you know, A Fine Balance. I absolutely loved those books and are among... There are very few books that I've read twice. I've read both of those books two times. Mm-hmm. And I guess... Who else? Maybe Barbara Kingsolver. Her book, The Poisonwood Bible, is about a minister and his four daughters. And that book, I think, stayed with me for 10 years. Yeah. Of course, C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud. Who else? Elizabeth Strout. She's an American writer. But,
Well, I want to. We're going to take a quick break in a minute, but I want to. Before we get to that, I want to get into talking about A Secret Music. And can you give us a really quick plot synopsis of what the book is all about?
Okay. It's about the mother bond, the healing power of music, and the link between genius and madness. And these three themes are woven around the story of a young pianist who desperately wants to make a mark on the world with his talent. How's that?
It sounds good.
Okay.
Well, let's take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and continue our conversation with author Susan Doherty. I'm your host, Robert White, and you're listening to Arts Connection on Faith FM. Arts Connection. You've been listening to All Gift from the Mike Janssen CD, Nudging Forever. I'm your host, Robert White. We're going to continue our conversation with author Susan Doherty. You talked a little bit about what the book was about before we went to break, but where did the idea for A Secret Music come from? Sort of what's the genesis of the book?
Well, I guess, you know, the universe conspired to make this book happen. It really began with two people and two stories. And, you know, the first was my husband's mother, my mother-in-law, and the second was my father. And they were both born in the era of the book, which is the 1930s. And both of them kept aspects of their childhood a deeply guarded secret. And so I'll start with my mother-in-law. She suffered from lifelong depression. And I wanted to try and understand the root of her mental illness, like what were the triggers, because I think the medical community agrees that mental illness is genetic heritability and environmental influences. So I wanted to look at what had happened to her life. And, you know, she recently passed away from Alzheimer's disease, but one summer several years ago, and she was in that twilight zone where the filters were off, and suddenly she began to talk about the year she turned 13, and it was so out of character for her to share her early life, but her childhood tumbled out. She was an identical twin. I mean, if you look at pictures of her, you just can't distinguish one twin from the other. And Marilyn, her twin, had a form of genetic hemophilia. Her body didn't make platelets, and when she got her first period, she died. And, you know, Marilyn had been sick leading up to her death, you know, bleeding noses and cuts that wouldn't heal. But it had been kept secret from Merle, my mother-in-law, and so as not to upset her. But it was a terrible shock when Marilyn died. And, you know, I just believe that death of her twin sister was the root of my mother-in-law's lifelong suffering. And, you know, in A Secret Music, in draft one, I had two sets of twins, and in draft eight, I had none. Lawrence and Patricia twins, but I used the essence of my mother-in-law's experience in the narrative. Christine Nolan, she's one of the main characters. She struggles with the burden of being the one who survived. And then the second part of the serendipity angle is about my father. You know, he's another person who steadfastly refused to share details of his own childhood. And, you know, I knew, my brothers all knew, we all knew that terrible things had happened to him, but he just didn't want to cast that dark, scary shadow across our lives, and he just refused to talk about what had happened to him when he was a young boy. And my daughter studied under Rohinton Mistry's wife, Rennie Mistry. She was an English teacher at Branksome Hall in Toronto, and Rennie had the girls do a biography, and Elise chose my father. So my father took that exact time to give Elise all the details of her of his childhood, which he wrote about in a biography, and then he died, which was so incredible. It's almost like Elise was the conduit of his story, and I was meant to, you know, make sense of or archive, you know, the certain events that happened to him to give some light, or how to shape the family experiences, you know, the good, the bad, the tragic. What are the takeaways from his mm-hmm. life? So those were the two big influences that led to A Secret Music.
Well, one of the things I found when I was reading The Secret Music was the detail in the book. And you know, you've got the details about classical music and music competitions, the Montreal during the Depression and mental illness. And you just talked about the two family members and that. What kind of research did you have to do to really flesh out the book and get the detail that you have in there?
That was such a fun part of the writing. I pretty much wrote the book at the Westmount Library, and I looked at newspaper archives. I pretty much read every single newspaper in the 1930s on microfiche, and you know, pulled a lot of the fun details from newspaper articles. And you know, I did a lot of research on mental illness in the 1930s at the Douglas Hospital, and I have to say the transparency was amazing, and as a result of doing research at the Douglas, that's what's led me to my second book, but we can talk about that in a minute. So when I went to the Douglas, I read patient files, and I watched shock therapy and metrazole shock therapy and some of the, you know, methods that were used to treat mental illness in the 1930s that of course are no longer used today, mm-hmm. but it just gave me real knowledge about how mental illness was treated in the 1930s. And of course, there was so much stigma and, you know, schizophrenia and bipolar and OCD and all of these, depression, none of that had been really categorized as such as it's known today. And, you know, it was an insane asylum. You were insane. You were in the loony bin. There were thousands of people in these institutions. I mean, in Toronto, there was the Clark Institute, the Douglas. I mean, it was a very sad time for mental mm-hmm. illness.
Well, one of the things I find when people are researching that and doing that is you end up with so much research. How did you sort of decide what you were going to keep in and what you decided was going to be relevant to the story?
Well, to be honest, it was my editor who made a lot of those cuts. My first draft was much bulkier. It was 400 pages. It ended up being 300 pages in the end. And I had all kinds of research on the CP rails and the slaughterhouse industry and rendering and the Sacred Heart Convent and just everything was, there were thousands and thousands of things. And I had notebooks on this and notebooks on that. And in the end, what I did is I put the plot on recipe cards and, you know, important scenes, and then I could move them around. And I knew that I wanted to start off with the radio because in the 1930s, you know, we just can't underestimate how important the radio was for Canadians. I mean, the land that is now Canada had coalesced into, you know, one nation because of radio. Everybody in each province could listen to music, listen to the news, listen to, it brought us together as never before. And because of the Canadian content rules, the radio inadvertently became the premier showcase for Canadian performers and composers. You know, NBC and CBS, they had great advertising, and, you know, they didn't have to have just American talent, and so therefore, you know, their shows were heavily funded and, you know, far greater success. But the CBC was an amazing showcase for Canadian performers. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Wilfred Peltier. So I begin the book with the CBC and Wilfred Peltier. He was, you know, such an influential man in Quebec, because he did two things. A, he finessed the English-French divide in music in Quebec, because the McGill Conservatory at the time in the 1930s really only accepted English musicians. And Wilfred Peltier really wanted a place for Quebec musicians to learn, number one, institutions. And secondly, his whole idea of fostering Canadian music would only survive if children were brought and taught to love music. So, you know, he did incredible things for Quebec and incredible things for Canadian music.
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to take one another quick break and one final break. And after that, we'll finish our conversation with author Susan Doherty. I'm your host, Robert White, and you're listening to Arts Connection on Faith FM. Welcome back to Arts Connection. You've been listening to Glimmer from Mike Janssen's Nudging Forever CD. I'm your host, Robert White. We're going to wrap up our conversation with author Susan Doherty. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the fact that A Secret Music was the winner of this year's Grace Irwin Prize, which is Canada's largest literary prize for Christian writers. What went through your mind when you first heard that you'd won that award?
Well, it was actually a very difficult time for me because I had a stem cell transplant on June the 2nd of this year, and I actually wasn't able to attend the award ceremony. I thought that I would be going, because my transplant was supposed to be in March with my brother as the donor, and so anyway, nothing sort of panned out that way, and I ended up having to have a universal donor from Germany. But my brother attended the awards ceremony and called me from the stage with his cell phone to say, "Oh my goodness, Susan, you've won the Grace Irwin Award." And I shook for 2 hours. It was a really incredible moment, and I'm so proud and so honored to be, you know, among the list of winners of the Grace Irwin. It's such an incredible organization.
Mm-hmm. Now that you've had a chance to sort of sit back and reflect on it, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I reread my book just in anticipation of this interview with you, you know, looking for the Christian themes. And, you know, it's funny, I hadn't started out to write a book about faith. It's just that in the 1930s, you know, I grew up as a Catholic. I'm still very much a Catholic. To really write authentically about Lawrence Nolan in the 1930s in Montreal, his Catholic faith was a huge part of life. I mean, the rituals of Mass and the sacraments and all of that became a very important part of the book just because that was very relevant and indicative of the 1930s. So, do you know, just for a moment about my new book is called The Ghost Garden, and it's a memoir about schizophrenia. And, you know, in conversation with the chief of staff at the Douglas Hospital, I told David Bloom, I said, have you realized that every single person with schizophrenia has this deep belief in God? And he said, no, I never noticed that. And it's something that I've talked to with all of the patients that I volunteer with. And Willie Dirkovich explained it best, and he said, you know, when you have schizophrenia, it's such a terrible disease that you have this deep-rooted sense that where they're going is someplace better, and their belief in God is really and truly a part of their psyche. It's really beautiful.
Right. Well, I need to wrap up, and what I want to find out is if people are interested in following more information about you and your next book or A Secret Music, where can they get information about this?
A Secret Music is available on Amazon, amazon.ca, and I'm hoping amazon.com very soon. It's available at amazon.ca, Indigo. It's in most Toronto bookstores, I think, at Indigo for sure. And my website tells a little bit more about myself, and that's SusanDohertyHannaford.com, and that's Susan, D-O-H-E-R-T-Y, Hannaford.com.
Great. Susan, thanks very much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you for listening to Arts Connection today, and thank you to my guest, Susan Doherty. And if you miss a broadcast or want to hear it again, look for archive programs on our website at artsconnection.ca. And be sure to tune in next week for another look where faith, arts, and Canadian culture meet. For more information on Arts Connection, email robert@artsconnection.ca. Follow us on Twitter @SayLaw13. Look for the Arts Connection page on Facebook, or check out the Arts Connection blog at blog.artsconnection.ca. For Arts Connection, I'm your host, Robert White, saying good day and God bless.